Welcome to Gascast, the monthly podcast for trainee anaesthetists in the UK. I'm Rick Thomas, and here to help me navigate the uncharted and potentially murky waters of anaesthetic podcasting are Mark Salmon.
Hello.
Beck Smith.
Hi.
And Frank Schneider.
Hi there.
So we'll kick off by discussing what's caught our eye this month in the world of anaesthesia and medicine. And Frank, I think you've been looking at the new ALS guidelines.
Yeah, I have. This is obviously a... something that we're, as anaesthetists, we're always looked at to know what we're doing. So although it's pretty straightforward and perhaps a bit boring if you are up to date with your ALS, but I don't think anyone's managed to escape the fact that the new guidelines came out in November and they're slowly being integrated into new ALS training courses. And really was just going to highlight the ones that were obvious to me. Something that's been taught on ALS courses for a while now is the attempt to prevent interruptions to chest compressions and getting back onto the chest as soon as defibrillation attempts are delivered. And that's obviously come through and been emphasized in the guidelines. And then there's a couple of interesting changes with regards to drug administration as well as drug delivery. And then, again, something I think has been happening for some time is increasing the types of patients that are cooled after cardiac events. And we're no longer really just cooling out of hospital VF arrests, which was what the research studies were based on, as you all know, but really including that to certainly in hospital to all cardiac arrests.
So it's all cardiac arrests, including in hospital ones, however long the downtime, everybody gets cooled now.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, anecdotally, that certainly has been happening at the hospitals I've been working at. And I don't know that there's enough good research out there, but, and it's obviously, as is the case with any resuscitation research, it's just very difficult to perform good research.
You say that, but one of the things that I think was really interesting in these new guidelines was, as you said, the keeping your hands on the chest. I think it's while they're charging the defibrillator, you're meant to carry on.
I did my ALS last week, and what you do is you have a pause. You sort of inform everyone what you're going to do, that you're going to check the rhythm. And then you continue compressions, and then you have a quick rhythm check, start compressions again, and if it's shockable, the team leader then decides to charge, and everyone else stands back while it's charging, and then just the person doing the compression stops while it defibrillates.
And you have to wear rubber gloves for that, but just normal gloves. Yeah. I actually chased down the reference from the guidelines that Frank sent through to a paper in a journal called Circulation in 2008, which was a fantastic study. And it's something I've always thought must be true, because you know when you go to Bex, I don't know if your ALS course, did they give you the standard horror story about the house officer who got defibrillated at an arrest, and the resus officer then had to go and look after them as well as the patient who had died? I've certainly heard that heard that hundreds of times. Well, not hundreds of times, but every time I go to a new hospital and I have to go and do the resus course. But I've always thought, as long as the pads are properly applied, you've got a positive and a negative, and you know, where's this charge going to go? This article in Circulation, what the investigators actually did, they bravely, you know, in the tradition of good medical research, put themselves forward as the test subjects, took a load of people having DC cardioversion for AF, and actually, once they're anaesthetized, put pressure on the chest and then kept their hands there like you would do to simulate chest compressions while the patient was cardioverted, and then attached themselves to some kind of resistance meter so they could measure what current was actually going through them, i.e. the leakage current. And not only did they not feel anything every time it was done, and I think it was nearly 100 times or something, the leakage current was minuscule, which is what I've always suspected would happen. So, because I was told we were going to go to hands-on defibrillation, which I think is even cooler.
That does make good physical sense, but you do still have to take your hats off to the ethics committee, first of all, and to the investigators.
Yeah, I think to the investigator, from an ethics committee point of view, you're not really putting the patient at, you know, any greater risk, are you?
No, it
is just the investigators who are taking it all on themselves. But yeah, fantastic piece of research. And what I've always suspected, there's no reason why you should just having a, you know, touching the patient, you should get an electric shock. It would be a leakage current, and, you know, that should be by all rights small.
That's some good science there, Rick. Can I ask you, Frank? I noticed in the airways section of the changes to the guidelines, it says there is reduced emphasis on early tracheal intubation.
Yeah.
So are they suggesting we carry on with compressions and ignore the airway, or use simpler methods to maintain an airway, or what? As anaesthetists turning up, should we? What should we be doing?
Well, you're quite right. I think this is an interesting point to debate as anaesthetists, and I'm sure we've all had various takes on reactions upon our arrival at a crash call. And certainly I know I've discussed with yourself, Mark, and a couple of other colleagues, as ultimately, I think there used to be certainly a lot of pressure on the anaesthetist to go ahead and intubate. And I think there's a view that perhaps intubation is not necessary, or certainly not immediately necessary, depending on what your general feelings are about the outcome of the patient, the suitability of the resuscitation attempt, and whether or not you're able to ventilate adequately with a bag valve mask and other sort of more simple airway maneuvers. Aside from that, I think what the guidelines emphasize is that time's not to be wasted in intubation attempts. Which can prevent adequate chest compressions, either because those people performing chest compressions are asked to stop so that it becomes easier to intubate, or I think the emphasis again in the guidelines is that intubation attempts should occur if there's an experienced person to do so, but that chest compressions certainly shouldn't be delayed or interrupted for the sake of prolonged intubation attempts. And I think that's a sensible way to look at it, and I think most of us would subscribe to that opinion.
The manual says basically that the risk of failed intubation is so massive that it's better not to intubate unless you're really skilled. So i.e. or non-anaesthetists, the first thing that they should put down is a supraglottic airway device. So they recommend the LMA or predominantly the iGel. So you'd need less inflation pressure, less gastric regurg and that sort of thing. And then only in those special circumstances like poisonings and drowning and pregnancy, where those you've got increased risk of aspiration, those ones you should definitely consider early intubation. But otherwise, even for anaesthetists, they reckon that you can manage with the iGel and that you can probably manage non-synchronous, so just continuous chest compressions without having to worry about doing 30 to 2 after you've got the iGel in.
Yeah, I think it's a theme that's carried through from certainly I think that originally came from American sort of layperson CPR, where people just weren't keen to do mouth-to-mouth anyway, and I think the emphasis there has been on doing compression-only CPR in many cases. I think you do need to differentiate between pre-hospital cardiac arrests and in-hospital, where you probably have a trained anaesthetist available quite quickly. And that's probably what the emphasis is on ALS teaching. I was just interested, Bex, as well, on the ALS courses, are they, given that you've done it recently, are they teaching the new guidelines, presumably? Or?
Yeah. So from January, all the courses are on the new guidelines, and there's a new manual out. And so there's a few other changes, like with regards to drugs. I don't know if you managed to have a chance to read, but like on the PAA systole branch of the ALS algorithm, you don't give atropine anymore. Because they don't think that it will be due to parasympathetic, you wouldn't have such a, it's unlikely that you would have a bradycardia so significant that it would cause arrest, which wouldn't respond to, your reversible causes in the adrenaline. And then on the other arm, on your shockable side, you give the adrenaline after the third shock together with amiodarone.
Amiodarone.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, all of those guidelines are very nicely presented on the Resus Council website. And I think generally our consensus was all very sensible and good.
And I hate to single you out, Rick, but of course to all of us who have iPhones, just to be reminded that there is an iResus application, which has obviously been updated with the 2010 guidelines. And is worth downloading. It's a free app. And should you need reminding in those quiet hours of your night shift as to what's changed, that's a good place to start.
Excellent. Yet another reason why I shall rush straight out and buy an iPhone. So, Bex, you've been having a look at the maternal death report on the H1N1 outbreak. So what have you found there?
Yeah, I found it on the Royal College of Obs and Gynae website. It's a report about the flu epidemic that between 2009 and 2010, and it was just the report's been released quite recently in December. There were a total of 12 deaths between April 2009 and January 2010, but the report actually focuses just on 8 deaths, and this is because they only added the flu addendum to the maternal death notification from September 2009. It's actually a really interesting report in that there were, yeah, as I said, these 8 deaths. Socioeconomically, there weren't really any major risk factors for these women. They had a median age of 28 and a BMI of 23, with singleton pregnancies. However, if you look at the deaths, they did actually have a lot of comorbidities. Like, for example, one had a BMI of 14, another one had a previous CVA, smokers, and one was obese. So they have got comorbidities. Of all of these patients, I think what was really interesting is patients presented and deteriorated really rapidly. If you compare pregnant to non-pregnant people, pregnant women have got 4 times increased risk of needing to be admitted to hospital with flu and a 7 time greater risk of ending up in the intensive care. And it's got recommendations that they had looked at, having looked at the all the case notes from these 8 women that died. And really the factors that they brought up was that there wasn't early recognition or suspicion of H1N1. When there was delay in diagnosis because of issues like the wrong swab being used or an initially false negative swab in one case, which had to be repeated. And so women weren't given the treatment early. It's supposed to be in the first 48 hours. And also there was quite a lack of multidisciplinary sort of teamwork about the care and lack of communication between the different teams. So it really just recommends, as always, good communication, early treatment and investigations to rule out differential diagnoses, and just a really strong emphasis that all health professionals have a responsibility to make sure pregnant women are either vaccinated, or that you suspect the diagnosis, and anyone who comes to hospital, all of the women had a cough, shortness of breath and fever at presentation, and then proceeded to deteriorate really rapidly.
That was very much the bottom line of the report, though, wasn't it? That
yeah,
it was none of these women were vaccinated, and treatment that they had been offered was either not taken in the form of Tamiflu or was slow to be initiated. But it seems that sort of the global mistrust of vaccination, which is still quite prevalent, and especially with the added point of these women being pregnant, that and then being offered Tamiflu was something that didn't happen in any of these situations. Although I agree with you, and having looked through the case reports, there were all sorts of delays. But that's not that, I would say that's probably fairly common for lots of the, you know, patients that end up getting scooped to ITU. I don't know what the rest of you think.
I think it's quite a pity because from the look of it, the side effects of the Tamiflu and the Zanamivir, which is the other one, there is only really nausea and vomiting. There doesn't seem to be any other side effects, and I think that's probably more to do with patient education.
Yeah, I agree. What struck me after reading it was that all of the cases had been fairly obviously ill with shortness of breath and tachycardia and fever, and were quite often not picked up as seriously ill until quite far into the illness.
But they did deteriorate very quickly, so I think you can't, you know, I mean, with this one, they went from being sort of fine to hypoxic within 8 hours, you know, actually there was 2 of them. So, you know, I think they have to have it.
But another one was in hospital for 3 days before they got a chest x-ray.
Yes, I think what I mean to say is having that high index of suspicion with this group of patients.
It's crucial, yeah.
And anticipating that the deterioration can be very rapid.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. I've got one question that came from the report, which was, and this is probably me being really thick, but they said there were 3 sort of groups of healthcare professionals that need to be involved. Obviously, the obstetricians, the intensivist, and they wanted a haematologist as well. Why? I mean, I didn't see microbiologists mentioned particularly often, but yeah, a couple of times the sort of a consultant haematologist was seen as a key member of the team. I don't know, is it me being stupid or is...
Was that, well, didn't a few of the cases present as obstetric complications. Is that why?
Yeah, two presented as obstetric complications, but I don't think they would have required a haematologist for that specifically. If you look at the reasons for death, the two of them died from intracranial bleeds secondary to anticoagulation for ECMO. And so I wondered if it was related to that for haematology. Maybe they wanted some input from that, like multi-organ dysfunction and coagulopathy and then the ECMO.
So people on ECMO need haematology input to make sure they don't have...
Yeah, that's what I was going to suggest. I think that probably is why.
Well, I can't be sure, but that's all I could gather, yeah.
I imagine it's a tricky balance, obviously, to keep them on ECMO safely and the concomitant risk of bleeding whilst being anticoagulated to stay on ECMO. It was interesting to see because they had... there were 17 referrals to Leicester, weren't there?
Yeah.
And then 4 deaths there.
Yeah.
I think 3 out of the 8 cases had ECMO, and they reckon the patients that went to Leicester would have, in all likelihood, died had they not received ECMO.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it's hard to say. They haven't got, obviously, a huge number, but, well, hopefully there won't be any more this year, but it is hard to make assumptions, I think, from only 8 cases.
But anyway, the bottom line is to be aware of the increased risk in pregnancy, to be vigilant, suspect it, and to sort of help educate the public about vaccination and antivirals. In fact, they are quite safe and the side effect profile is low.
Yeah.
And on that last point, is it because obviously one of the things they mentioned as well is the low uptake of the vaccination, which just seems, in view of the fact of how poorly these women do, seems a tragedy that it's not being promoted more convincingly to pregnant women.
Well, I mean, there was a whole issue about the government's vaccination program being put on hold and then started. I think it was started late, wasn't it, for this round of seasonal flu. And then there is, of course, the general anti-vaccination movement at the moment, which I have to say I think is partly to blame. I don't know if anybody agrees with that or you think that's a bit far-reaching.
No, I think we could ask Mark to share his views on the MMR debacle.
You know, I think that's a whole separate podcast, but absolutely, I think there is a powerful anti-vaccine movement which is kind of gets incorporated with a whole generic anti-medicine, anti-science type thing, which, don't get me started on that, on this.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a whole separate thing, but I can't help but feel that sort of pervasive thinking might have something to do with, why normally sensible people are a bit like, might risk it, might be all right. Anyway, moving on to a slightly lighter topic, what caught my eye, for me, the standout piece of news this month was the Royal College launching their Twitter feed. Just for anyone who doesn't, who's not familiar with Twitter, obviously you can't really not have heard about it, but it's a micro-blogging service. And I've got to say, I actually wasn't on Twitter until the Royal College started their Twitter feed, for which I'm hugely grateful because I've really enjoyed it over the last couple of weeks. And it's been fantastic.
Using only the edges of your seats now that you're on the Royal College Twitter feed.
I am. It's a roller coaster ride of fascinating bits of information. No, it's mainly because I've been following other people on Twitter, I've got to say. But my concept of it was, it's this micro blogging service where you've got people spouting out 140 characters of, bits of relatively useless information, which I'm sure is what 99% of the general chatter on Twitter is. But the way it's actually presented, if you choose who you follow and you're following various organizations like the BMJ or any of the science journals or the Royal College, it's a great way of getting news out. You can sit there with your Twitter feed open and something will pop up with a URL. You can click through if you're interested. It's fairly non-invasive. I think it's just, I used to use an RSS aggregator. And the trouble with that is, obviously, it requires somebody who's got control of the website to then put something on an RSS feed, whereas anybody can tweet, and you can follow anybody. It's very easy to unfollow people. I think it's a really nice system. I've got to say, now I can with choosing who I've been following, it's been really good and quite informative. And I think as an effective means of communication for an organisation like the Royal College, I think it's really good. The last few tweets they've had, I have actually been through and looked at their sedation guidelines on propofol. Again, they've got an H1N1 update, and then they just tweeted that there was, you know, 2.9 million GAs given annually, which is interesting. I wouldn't have gone to the website, the college's website, to specifically had looked for that piece of information, but it was something that I was pleased to find out when I was sitting at my desk the other day. So I think it's great. Although with the caveats of obviously you need to be quite careful about how you use it. There was a nice, I don't know if anybody else read the editorial in the bulletin about why they were using Twitter, especially with the quite inordinate £55,000 a year they spend on postage, which I thought was a very good reason not to. But yeah, obviously there have been various Twitter debacles, such as Gillian McKeith having to retract all of her Twitter statements, then close her account and then pretend it wasn't hers.
Do you think the college is going to do that at some point?
Well, no, this is the thing. This is what I was getting up to. I don't think the college is going to do that. But you know when you guys probably don't know, but Mark does, when you go on Twitter, something pops up and suggests people like the Royal College of Anaesthetists. So I was like, well, who's going to be like the Royal College of Anaesthetists? And Peter Venn popped up, who's the guy, I don't, you guys are probably aware, is the editor of the college bulletin.
We remember him well.
So yeah. So I thought, okay, so I'll go through to his Twitter feed, because it just came up as a thing, just to see what he's been doing. He has been busily tweeting expletives, it turns out, which certainly made me ROTFLOL.
That is unexpected,
he's tweeted an expletive, and then in the next tweet gone, ignore my rant, it was meant for one tweeter only, now I'm starting to understand the system better, which I thought was a little bit ironic, seeing as he was the guy who wrote the editorial and was the main, or seemed to be one of the main people involved in getting this up and started. I think it's going quite well, the Royal College Twitter feed. They've got 149 followers as of this morning, which
150, it's 150 right now.
It was 150 right now, well, I mean, I don't know, I think that's fairly good, seeing as you know, I don't know how many people are on Twitter. There are, I had a quick look through the 2007 census from the Royal College and totted it up, and there's about 12,600 anaesthetists in the UK. So that is only 1.18%, but they are still in their first month. So it's encouraging.
Early days.
It's early days, and it's encouraged me to get on Twitter. I mean, I'm not exactly technophobic, but I wasn't on Twitter until the Royal College went. They've got me on Twitter, so I'm sure they'll get more people on there. And I was all for it. I was pleased. And yeah, I think that'll be a good way.
I found sorry to interrupt you, Rick. I found this and some market research that was done on Twitter. It's by this company called Peer Analytics, and it was done in San Antonio. And they looked at this 2-week period in August 2009. And they classified all the different tweets that were online, and 40% of them were categorized as pointless babble.
Only 40.
Which is ominous.
And then,
an extra 38% was considered conversational. There was some self-promotion, a bit of pass-along value, 4% spam, and 4% news. So I think the Royal College will make an important contribution to increasing the news percentage.
Well, I mean, it's all about who you follow, though. And, you know, you can choose who you follow. And
yeah, you can be quite discriminate, can't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, what I from some of the stuff you sent around, Rick, I mean, if you look, I mean, it's an amazing growth spurt, isn't it? From Feb 2008 to Feb 2009, Twitter grew by 1,382%. So, I mean, who's to say that the Royal College followers won't, they may not enjoy that kind of growth. But, you know, as it becomes a better known resource, I'm sure, and, you know, people who are on Twitter will, or anaesthetists who are on Twitter will most likely subscribe to or follow the Royal College just because they want to know what's being tweeted about.
Absolutely. And just for those of you who are worried about it, I did look it up, and you can delete your tweets. So, you know, a bit of information for everyone there.
Do you think that's what Peter Venn's doing?
I think hopefully when he listens to this, well, I don't know. He can write whatever he wants on his Twitter page. It's entirely up to him. Just, you know, everyone can read it. So moving on, Mark, you've been having a look at the new NPSA guidance on non-lure lock devices for spinal epidurals that I noticed is coming into force on April Fool's Day this year.
That's right, Rick. And, well, if, this is the thing. As far as news goes, this isn't new. This was published on the 24th of November, 2009. What makes it interesting to me is, as you say, we are rapidly approaching D-Day, the first part of this. By first part, I mean from the 1st of April of this year, all spinal bolus doses and lumbar puncture samples should be performed using syringes, needles, and other devices with connectors that will not also connect with IV equipment. And that's, as you say, that
it's
means...
It's 2013, isn't it?
No, no. 2013 includes epidurals. 2011...
Oh, sorry.
...spinals. And so what's interesting is none of the hospitals I know of have any of these things, and that's largely because none of the manufacturers are ready to roll yet. The other problem is, having talked to some of the reps for these companies, is that the NPSA seem to have rushed out these guidelines before there's an implementation of an international standard. So we now have the exciting anesthetic equivalent of VHS versus Betamax, because there's at least four different ideas. I've got some samples of several of them, and you know, they all do what they're supposed to. Largely, they are variations on a lure. So, a lure, for anyone who doesn't know, is a 6% taper invented by a Hermann Wolfing lure in the 19th century to put stoppers in bottles. So that 6% taper is just enough to grip. A male.
That's also a fantastic nerd fact for your next really boring anesthetic conversation.
Whip
you have
that out
on
in
the
your
list.
Primary viva. So there's a male end usually on the syringe and a female end on the back of the spinal needle.
So, Mark, if I understand you correctly, though, from the bits of kit that you've had a look at, that they don't sound like they're interchangeable, so you can't use one company's kit with, say, one company's syringe with another company's needle.
No, I mean, there's some overlap in that some of the companies, like this surety method, has been taken up by several different manufacturers of needles and syringes, whereas some manufacturers have come up with their own unique ones. So the point is, most of them don't seem to be ready. A lot of the companies I contacted said they would come and talk to me about them, but they didn't have samples ready to go because they're not ready to sell yet. But this is all at odds with the guidance. This document says that we should have them in stock by now, basically. They said we should have stopped ordering old stock 6 months ago.
What I don't understand is, why has it taken so long? Because if we've been having all these number of drug errors noted in the, you know, of administration errors noted in NAP3, and there was the case of the intrathecal vincristine in 2000, and it's 11 years later and we haven't come up with a system, compared to, say, you know, the anesthetic machine where you've got your ventilation tubing and your scavenging are completely not interchangeable. Why has it taken so long to develop something?
Changing these things over was one of four specific targets that they reported on in the year 2000. But that report led to more reports in 2001, and then started advertising to inventors and designers to come up with solutions in 2002. The NPSA got involved in 2004 with risk assessments. In 2006, there was research started on different types of connectors and running them through simulated clinical situations. It seems like it should be easy to change, but clearly it isn't.
I mean, I think it's probably got a lot to do with manufacturing will. I mean, that's one of the things that's going to cost them money and time to develop. In the meantime, people need spinal epidural needles. It's much easier to them to have the machine press everything out the same size. So we'll just carry on until an actual directive comes along. You need some incentive, like a directive, to force a change in the system. Otherwise, it doesn't matter to them if people put down spinal epidural needles. It doesn't come back on the manufacturer, does it?
I guess watch this space. I would be very surprised if we make the change by April. But the things I see all look fine. Look like they won't massively change the way we work. Just and another safety device, I don't think is a bad thing.
So we'll have to see what happens from April, if they'll all be madly burning boxes of spinal needles out the back of theatres, and we'll be getting a whole new set, which I'm sure everyone complain about because they won't fit together the same, and people always struggle with change. So moving on to Discovery of the Month, where we're all going to tell each other about a couple of things that have new things in either anesthesia, medicine, or just general life avoidance type material that we've come across that we've found interesting and want to share with everyone. So I'll start with two discoveries I've got, in fact. One of them is a free and open source statistics package that I've been enormously impressed with and wanted to tell you about. It's if you're like me and you're not very good at statistics and you've never really understood them and you've, you know, just about got enough of a grasp to get through MCQs, and then every now and then you find doing an audit or something, it would be helpful or add some polish or, you know, potentially actually add some meaning to the piece of work you're doing. I've always tried to look online, and there are various places online you can go that have sort of stats web pages where you can input some data. But again, I've always, you know, struggled to, am I really using the right test? What the package is, it's called SOFA Statistics, and you can get it at sofastatistics.com. It's open source, so not only is it free of charge, it's actually, the source code is free if you're into that kind of thing. And it also runs on all platforms, so if you're a hippie Mac user, or you're a Windows user, or you're a Linux user, it'll work whatever you use. And it, the really nice feature about it is it's got a statistics wizard in the opening page, where it says it asks you what type of calculation you're trying to do, or what type of data set you're trying to manipulate, then takes you through a wizard and helps you sort of identify the most appropriate test. So I've, you know, really good, really helped me. It's actually enabled me to understand a little bit more about what I was doing. And I really love the fact it's open source and free, because a lot of the actual professional statistics packages, which I'm not quite sure how they stand or rate compared to SOFA with functionality, but they are horrendously expensive, hundreds and hundreds of pounds. So sofastatistics.com, check it out. And the other thing which really has changed my life is www.teaandkittens.co.uk. It's a very nice website which just displays pictures of cups of tea next to pictures of fluffy kittens that helps you with helps you get through stressful situations. And if you're a Firefox user, they've got a Mozilla plugin where anytime you're redirected or accidentally go to a web page from the Daily Mail or the Express, it redirects you to teaandkittens.co.uk, so saving your inner wrath. Well, particularly like that. It's helped me out already two or three times today.
What you mean? It's literally a cup of tea and some kittens.
Yeah.
Because everyone's going to be checking that out now.
I am. I'm on my iPhone as we speak.
The web stats are going to go through the roof, thanks to you.
How did you find out about this?
It was on someone's Twitter feed.
More importantly, how much time are you spending on that website?
Well, I'm on it right now. Anyway, so, yeah. Bex, what have you got for us?
Just a mindless fact, actually, that I thought was quite interesting, was that one of my consultants who's really into his airway stuff told me that adults don't usually develop stridor until the tracheal orifice has narrowed down to 7 millimeters. And so therefore, if you do ever have to intubate someone with stridor, by default, the only tube that you should really take with you is a size 5 MLT tube, because, you know, it will fit through the narrowed orifice. And I thought that was quite an interesting fact, because I never really thought about the crucial diameter that you need.
That's interesting. I mean,
that's quite handy.
That is quite handy. I mean, it seems obvious that you should probably, if someone's got stridor, you should take a small tube rather than a big tube with you. I don't know how.
This is why you're such a good anaesthetist, right?
Yes, it's because of my incredible ability to point out the blindingly obvious. But I mean, that's
all right. I would argue that I'm helping them out by dilating their trachea back up to a size 8.5.
Just biopsying while you're there,
reaming out their vocal cords. But I mean, how does someone do the study on that? That by the time, what do they do? Do lots of fiber optics on people with stridor? and measure their tracheal diameter.
Well, you can probably mathematically model it, can't you? Because it'll be to do with the radius and
airflow dynamics.
Yeah, physics.
I'm not entirely sure. I did think it was interesting.
Rick, you should be able to do a quick calculation on the back of a napkin.
Yeah, sorry. Okay, so there's the smart and obvious answer. So thanks for clearing that up for me. Yeah, well, that's an interesting and useful fact. Frank, how can you follow that up?
Well, I was having quite a quiet month, actually. And then this morning, I was asked to come and give a hand anaesthetizing a six-year-old, which at first I thought was a bit unusual. And then went to see this child. Well, I only met him in the anaesthetic room. And discovered from Mom that he has Angel Man syndrome.
Sounds familiar, but that? Is that the I dancing man that's ignorant. Got the like a puppet? Puppet walks like a puppet?
Oh, I have, but I can't remember.
Yeah, except it's bad form to call them puppet children anymore, as I've found out for obvious reasons. No, well, look, I mean, Wikipedia makes a reference to puppet children, so I think you're well within your rights. But you're quite right. It's a neurogenetic disorder that's chromosome 15 abnormality, which is slightly related to Prader-Willi, which I did know about. But they are, I mean, they were originally described as puppet children. Well, that has become a bit of a derogatory term, I suppose, because they have typically have jerky movements, often sort of hand flapping or of their arms. And but oddly enough, just usually very happy demeanors, lots of smiling and laughing. And with this, they have various aspects of developmental delay, including very poorly developed speech, specifically, as well as seizure disorders. Having said that, this child was absolutely fine, and he was lovely, sleeping comfortably, and he had a very uneventful anaesthetic. But it did teach me something about a long-forgotten syndrome, which I don't know if I'll encounter again.
Now I'm just going to tell you my favourite inappropriate syndrome, which is the dish face deformity, which I've just looked up on Merriam-Webster, which is a condition in which the face appears somewhat concave because of the underdevelopment of the nasal and maxillary regions, so-called dish face.
There's got to be a better name for it now.
Not according to this, but there you go. So finally, Mark, what gem have you got for us this month?
Well, this month I was going to do a website recommendation. I've lost it now because I'm looking at tea and kittens, but here we go. I'm a website for regional anaesthesia based in the UK. So it's www.ra-uk.org, Regional Anaesthesia United Kingdom. It's a nice website. It's basically the official site of the UK Regional Anaesthesia Group, so it's got lots of information about their guidelines and meetings and so on. But the bit I really like is their download section, which contains a whole range of videos of ultrasound guided blocks, which can be easily downloaded and put onto your generic mobile phone device and looked at in the 3 minutes in the anaesthetic room while you're waiting for your patient to arrive and you can't remember which is the median nerve and ulnar nerve and so on and so on. So yeah, that's my tip. Check it out. Lots of good videos to download and general resources on regional anaesthesia. That's www.ra-uk.org.
Thank you very much. Very useful. So our next section in our podcast is going to be our debate, where each month we pick a topic and that's hopefully topical and relevant to us all as trainee anaesthetists, put it out there and see what we come up with. This month we've chosen the European Working Time Directive, which came into force in August 2009, which I'm sure we all remember, but is in fact being reviewed in the EU at the moment. They announced in December 2010 that they were going to take another look at that, and I thought we'd just have a chat about what we think and how that's affected our lives and whether or not we think it's good or bad. Frank, I know you've done a little bit of reading around this topic.
Yeah, well, I think my intention was drawn to it, first of all, because as you probably, or a lot of us know, John Black, who's still the president of the Royal College of Surgeons, has always been quite vocal about the restrictions that European Working Time Directive have placed on training, and in a sense he's been vindicated by the fact that The Europe has now turned around and agreed that it's not workable in its current form and that it does need to be revised. Of course, they've not really elaborated on that and specified what those revisions are going to be. Whatever happens, I think we probably will need to see an increase in hours or an increase in the length of training.
One of the two from a training point of view, though. Certainly, that's a general consensus. But what about patient safety, which is the other issue, and presumably why this was instigated in the first place?
Well, I think there are issues of patient safety. I think those are the obvious ones of you know, being looked after by someone who's too tired to do the work in a safe and effective manner. And the other big issue, though, I think, is that we do, as well, consultants today, as well as you know, we as a trainee body looking towards becoming consultants one day, I think do have to take responsibility and look at the facts and realize that we are going to have to take a more important role in training of trainees in out of hours situations. I mean, I think there are going to be more and more, there is going to be more and more pressure to be resident on call for many disciplines. Certainly to work extended hours. And I think one of the downfalls of the current system is that if you are working out of hours, you just don't get enough supervision and don't get any training in those few hours that you are actually at work.
I think the problem with the shift system is that as you say, that there's less time spent training, which may be compensated for by having consultant cover at night. But whether the NHS can actually afford that is, you know, obviously quite a separate debate. But there's problems with the continuity of care, and that even more of your precious training time ends up being in lengthy handovers to try and, you know, compensate for the disruption of patient continuity. And I think it can be, it just... On the whole, I think at the end of the day, the patient safety is absolutely paramount, and you have to go with whatever the evidence is. And if there needs to be a review of the evidence, that's fine. But you know, I'm not sure. It's a balance of less training, and so you're possibly more alert but less experienced, versus possibly having more exposure but being more tired and more likely to make a mistake. It's a fine line to walk.
I quite agree with you, and it also depends on general workload you get. During a shift, for anaesthetists, I think most of us would agree it's easier to pace the workload. You're not constantly having to do something, and sometimes you might be sitting down in theatre, you've got busy periods, you've got rest periods, and it's quite easy to manage your workload. Whereas something like A&E does lend itself more to doing shift work, because you are going to be, you know, constantly seeing patients and constantly on the go. The Royal College of Surgeons think this is a big issue in their training. It does interrupt the amount of theatre time they get. I think particularly with regard to elective lists, you know, people who are on nights and potentially not operating are then taken off elective lists when they could actually be doing, you know, learning with their consultant.
Yeah. I think another benefit for us is if you use the catchphrase about the work-life balance, but presumably we should all be motivated enough that in our own time you can drive your own learning and educational development. And, you know, whether that's, as you say, postponing your CCT date and taking fellowships to increase your exposure that way, you know, you have to take responsibility for your own education as well. So, and you have the benefit of having the time to do that with this.
No, it's definitely been a while since I've done more than four nights, and I'm sure predates the EWTD. But still, my point being that after four nights, I still don't think I'm as good as I am on shift work. And I actually managed to find a few published studies looking at the difference in shift patterns. They're all actually, a couple of them were in something called the AIR Medical Journal, which was looking at neuropsychological testing of nurses who were doing either 12 or 18-hour shift difference, and found no difference at all, other than, in preference, they would rather do the 18-hour shift pattern with a day off in between. And again, between 12 and 24-hour shifts, there was no difference in performance on cognitive tests, just the fact that inconsistent sleep was the thing that caused a bigger problem. There was some work done in the journal Pre-Hospital Medicine in 2001, looking at, I'm not quite sure how relevant this is for us, but it was looking at paramedics and their ability to intubate people after 12 or having been up for 24 hours, and they found absolutely no difference. at all.
Do you remember there was an article published last year, I think it was in the BJA, where they attached the movement sensors to anaesthetist's hands?
Yes, yeah, I do.
And compared them whether they were sleep deprived or awake, and they actually had no increase in complications. They were just less, their hand movements were less efficient when they were inserting epidurals.
And I've got to say, I think if you were allowed, if we were back on a full shift system, because the, you know, the at the core of this debate is the fact that we're limited to 48 hours now, and the fact that we're not getting enough cases in our logbooks, and there's also all these gaps on the rotas, which I know we've all experienced. We've gone to hospitals where they just haven't got enough juniors at the moment to cover a rota where you're all working 48 hours. With a full shift system, it would be much easier to go back up to 56 or 68 hours and lead a reasonable work-life balance, doing a 1 in 6, which I think is what the Royal College of Surgeons initially proposed. Which I've got to say, I would put, I'll go out and say I would be happy with a 1 in 6 rota, 56 hours a week. I think that would probably, in many ways, suit me better, and I think I'd probably be able to deliver better care.
Is there a date given for the review of for this code? Because I think the you said the coalition government is going to review the European Working Time Directive. Is there a date given, or is it just
no, not in the in future? The blog post I found, which was from John Black. He's not actually mentioned in this when it was going to be, just that it was going to happen. But anything sort of European Union, I think, moves at a sort of very sloth-like pace. So I don't think we're all going to be changing our shifts anytime soon.
I think they did say that they were looking at having a review in place towards the end of the year. But, I mean, that's the timeline, whether or not they're going to stick to it. And given that, you know, we've been preparing for European Working Time Directive for the last few years, I don't know how realistic that is.
So what we're sort of concluding, it seems, is that it is definitely a complex issue, but one that doesn't necessarily need to be dictated for the whole European Union and by Brussels, and actually needs to be looked at more carefully on an individual specialty basis, where we can look at what the training requirements are, what the service requirements are, and deliver a tailored service as per specialty, as per hospital. Excellent. And on that note, we'll definitely have to end our debate there and move on to a final little section before we end our Gascast, which is a little bit of fun called Biology or Bunkum, where every month I'm going to present the other three with three biomedical news items, two of which are genuine and one of which is fictitious. And they have to try and see if they can tease out which is the falsehood and which are the genuine biomedical science articles. So, here we go. For number one, a team at KCL have adapted an MRI scanner to be as quiet as possible so they can monitor the development of white matter in sleeping infants. Number two, fecal transplants are being used in New York as a treatment for C. diff.
Fecal?
Fecal, that's right, fecal transplants. And number three, the science of quantum teleportation has been found to work with DNA, which can, in fact, use a weird form of this to teleport itself to another location.
How many of these are true?
Two of them are, in fact, true.
Right.
So do we get to question you, or do we just tell you what we think?
Yeah? No. You just have to tell me which one you think. Which go through them and say which one you think is wrong and why. Bex.
I think the fecal transplants, just because it sounds absolutely horrific.
Fecal transplantation. Any comments on the other two?
I think the first one is the bunkum. Because I think if Rick was going to make up something about feces, it would have been far more interesting than that.
you don't think fecal transplants are sufficiently interesting?
It sounds plausible.
What do you reckon, Frank?
I think the C. diff thing is true.
You think it's true?
Yeah. I'm siding with Mark on that. But also, I think, yeah, I could believe that. I would say the DNA teleportation. I'm struggling to figure out the science behind that.
Okay. Well, that's so we've got so that's a complete spread there. Okay, well, I'll take them through one by one then. We can say, so, Mark, you didn't like the MRI scanner.
No.
No, okay. This is in fact true. In the Journal of Neuroscience this month, a team at KCL have in fact got a MRI scanner to be quiet enough that they can have an infant sleep in it, and then apparently you can use it to monitor the development of their white matter as they sleep.
KCL? I thought you said KFC. That's what I thought that was for.
No backpedaling now, I'm afraid. But that is in fact amazing but true. And was related to an article which I saw about the difference in white matter configurations between transsexuals, actually, was where I picked that up from. But the
because you're widely read.
No, it was more a personal piece of research. But no, that is entirely true. So, coming on to the second one, taking these in order, fecal transplants. This is, in fact, a true and shocking phenomenon that is been around since the 1950s, apparently. People have been dabbling with the old fecal transplants. Just to give you a bit more information on it, there are two ways of doing it. One way is to drop an NG tube and then, having filtered out the large particles, to infuse the solution down the NG tube into the stomach and let it travel through that way. But most people think that, you know, the most sensible route is to infuse your solution of fecal transplant through a colonoscope. But in fact, it is currently being used in New York as a treatment for resistant C. diff, and was published in the Journal of Clinical Gastroenterology in September 2010. That was a case series where I think they purported to have very good results. So I'm afraid...
Now, how do I apply to be a donor?
Well, in fact, interestingly, they do try to take family donors. Not quite sure why. It does work with anybody, but they do like to have family donors. I think it's something to do with the testing that has to go on for other things.
I once had a wee on my sister's leg when she was stung by a jellyfish, but that takes it to a whole new level.
Yeah, was that successful? Did it work?
Well, I don't care if it works. It was good fun.
Right, let's move swiftly on. So, teleporting DNA, I'm afraid, was the bunkum. This was actually a genuine news story, in that it's a Nobel Prize winner, or you can't be an ex-Nobel Prize winner. Luc Montagnier, who won the Nobel Prize for Medicine, I think only a couple of years ago, for his work on HIV and AIDS, has gone a bit loopy, it would seem, and is claiming that he can teleport DNA from one beaker to another beaker by zapping it with some 7 hertz frequency radiation. And there's all sorts of sort of horrible homeopathic connotations with this. Like, the first thing he does is he dilutes the DNA in the beaker that's meant to have DNA in it down to such minuscule concentrations that it couldn't, you know, it couldn't feasibly actually have any molecules of DNA. He then zaps it with some electromagnetic radiation, a very low frequency, and then does a PCR reaction on the adjacent beaker of water that had nothing in it, and then, hey presto, produces the DNA. Which is strange, but, you know, genuinely out there. He has published this in a journal, but it is a journal which he himself set up and is editor of, so is potentially not subject to rigorous peer review. So
that's the way to do it.
That is indeed the way to do it. So that concludes our first show. We'll be back next month. With some more anesthesia news, science, and updates. Hope you enjoyed it. See you then.
Bye.
Bye.